Chapter 11 of Shedding, Dreams, and Prophecy. Kurama sat down at the Slytherin table under suspicious, unfriendly glares. "So," one of the fifth-year girls asked sweetly, "what's it like?" Kurama turned to her curiously.
"What's what like?"
"Slumming, associating with mudbloods and muggle lovers," she clarified.
Kurama reached up, brushing his fingertips against his translation earring. "I'm sorry, Miss..."
"Pansy Parkinson." The breakfast platters magically filled with food as she spoke.
"Miss Parkinson, that can't have translated right. Mud... blood? What's that?"
She huffed at his denseness and began ladling food onto her plate. "Muggleborns, of course."
Kurama smiled and started filling his own plate. "Oh, I see. Dirty heritage. We call that sort, harmborn. Roughly."
"Oh, so you do understand," Pansy beamed. He most certainly did. The word he'd given her didn't refer to muggle-born Japanese wizards. Of course, the harmborn Slytherins didn't have to know that. "But if you understand, why were you at the Gryffindor table?" she continued. Parkinson was clearly the interrogator of the group this morning, and Malfoy was doing nothing to stop the questioning. Kurama would have expected nothing else from the boy.
"Is there a reason I shouldn't have been?"
"Gryffindor is nothing but mudbloods and muggle lovers," she spat.
Kurama's eyes went wide, and, after a stunned moment, he went into a fit of laughter, stifled behind his hand.
"What?" she asked, offended.
"I'm terribly sorry, Miss Parkinson. I was just trying to imagine Hiei as a muggle..."
Another snicker.
"Lover. He barely tolerates us."
He slowly brought his laughter under control, though a bright, amused smile remained on his face.
"Anyway, to answer your question about why I was over there..." He paused and lowered his voice, wicked amusement lacing his words as he said cryptically, "I was diffusing a situation. It's going to be a very interesting year for the Gryffindors, with those three in residence. But I'd rather not start by disrupting my breakfast."
He tapped his chopsticks against his rice bowl pointedly. The Slytherin stared at him blankly, uncomprehending.
"What do you mean?" Pansy pressed.
"You'll see." A shift in the air distracted Kurama from toying with his house, and he looked up as several hundred owls, night silent in their flight, swooped into the great hall. There must be some sort of entryway for them in the rafters, he thought, watching as the birds dropped letters and parcels onto the tables and into students' laps. Malfoy received two owls. One was a plain bird with the copy of the paper, similar to most of the birds in the hall. But the other was a large, fierce, black owl with the arrogance of a hawk. It carried a large box, which Malfoy opened with the assurance that this was his due, revealing a multitude of expensive-looking trinkets and candies. Kurama peered at them curiously, noting that Malfoy was subtly displaying them for the table to view, probably to foster envy.
"Jealous, Minamino?" he sneered.
"Curious," Kurama corrected mildly. "I don't think I've seen any of those things."
"Oh, are you that poor?"
"No, but most of the products I've seen since I arrived aren't sold in Tokyo," Kurama replied. The boy really needed to learn the art of subtlety. The blonde scowled and turned away, closing his box so Kurama couldn't see it anymore. The rest of breakfast passed in unpleasant silence, with the nearby Slytherins taking their cue from the now sulking blonde. Kurama appropriated Malfoy's paper on the way out. After breakfast, when a number of giggling Hufflepuff girls had swept Yukina away from Kuwabara, Hiei ditched the rest of the students and returned to the tapestry he'd entered last night. The entrance was closed. Damn, he hadn't actually seen what the pranksters had done the night before to open it, and now he was stuck. Genkai should have given them a password.
"You little human hag shit," he hissed at the tapestry, in one of the Makai dialects. Most were much more satisfying to curse in than the mild, bland-sounding human ones, and this particular one was his favorite. The tapestry obediently opened. Hiei wasted a split second in shock before darting through and down the hallway to Genkai's door. The trap had been set off, he noticed, before he growled at the door in the same language. "Open!" The door did so, and Hiei stepped through, stopping when he caught sight of the old woman. She sat on her knees before a low table covered with scrolls of parchment, making notes on a sheet of rice paper, and apparently oblivious to the thick, neon-orange fur covering her skin up to her eyes. A pile of matching, shed fur encircled her, nearly an inch thick. "Come in, Hiei," she said unnecessarily. "You set the password to an entire language," Hiei snapped, somewhat mollified by amusement at Genkai's furry predicament. "It's temporary," Genkai said absently. "I'll change it to something all of you can remember later. What did you want?" "Fix the security." "I just told you I would." "The castle security," Hiei clarified. "Not your stupid password." "Make a list of the problems and I'll bring it up to the headmaster. Don't go trying to fix it yourself. No mere student could." She picked up a scroll from the far side of the table and thrust it at him. "And read this. We've got bigger problems than a few weak wards." Hiei raised an eyebrow, but unrolled the parchment and began reading it. 10 seconds later, he lowered it. "This is a joke." "You'd think that, wouldn't you? There's an entire year's worth of defense wasted on that Lockhart's ego, and next to no remedial work done in the 2 years since." She checked another scroll, a color-blocked chart of some sort, against her notes. "If we're lucky, whoever did this," she gestured towards her orange facial fur, "makes a habit of such pranks and has honed their classmates' reflexes. Perhaps I'll recruit him or her to do exactly that." "Them." "Oh?" Genkai raised an eyebrow, getting only haughty silence out of Hiei. "I see. I'll find the culprits myself." She paused. "Was there anything else?" "The new password." Genkai thought for a moment. "Greedy's paper-pushing brat." Hiei's eyebrow shot up at the most polite yokai reference to Koenma, and he slowly smirked. "Not bad." "Good. Scram."
"All right, Harry. Now will you tell us why you dragged us to the infirmary this morning?"
Harry turned away from his view of the Quidditch pitch, raising an eyebrow at Hermione. "It wasn't anything, just a mistake," he said.
"Nonsense. You were sure there was someone there, weren't you? Someone we know. And there was, though we didn't see who."
Harry looked down towards his feet as Hermione spoke.
"Who was it, Harry?"
"Just my imagination. Just..." He cut the rest off.
"Just what, Harry?" Hermione asked gently.
"A dream," he muttered. Ron cocked his head. "The one that left you sick?" he asked.
"No." "Why would a dream make you think someone was in the infirmary?" Hermione asked. "What happened? Was it you know who?"
"Yes."
"Who was hurt?" she pressed.
Harry held his silence for a moment, then sighed and muttered, "Snape."
"Snape?"
Ron and Hermione yelped.
"But Harry, Professor Snape is just fine," Hermione pointed out.
"I know that," Harry snapped. "Just not until breakfast," he added more calmly. Hermione and Ron looked at each other.
"You're not quite acting like you know it, though," Hermione said.
"I..." Harry began. "I don't... It seemed real. It still does." "But it didn't leave you sick," Ron said reasonably. "Your other dreams have."
"No, just the one did," Harry told him. "The others usually leave my scar sore, but that goes away pretty quick."
"Oh.
Did this one hurt your scar?" Hermione asked.
"Don't remember," Harry lied. He wanted this over with, but he didn't know whether he'd prefer to drop it or get it out in the open so someone else could try to make sense of it.
"All right, then," Hermione said decisively. "What happened in the dream?"
It looked like dropping it wasn't going to be an option.
"I don't remember much," Harry murmured. Mercifully, Hermione didn't point out that he remembered enough to be upset, as he paused to put the fading images in order.
"I was following a snake," he said finally. "His snake. We went into a room, and there were Death Eaters, and you know who was there. He started calling them by name, and the snake was making comments, and the last one was Snape." Ron started, but Harry caught his eyes, and Ron remained silent. "The snake called him a traitor, a spy, and wanted to bite him. I remember that much. Then he cast something, and Snape collapsed, and I woke up."
Hermione waited a beat, then asked, "What did he cast? An unforgivable?"
Yes. Harry concentrated, letting his eyes fall shut. That was one of the foggier bits of the dream. Voldemort had said something about letting Snape spy, then about beating death, and Snape's usefulness.
"Usefulness is at an end," Harry murmured, remembering. The mask had fallen, revealing Snape's face.
"I live, Severus, and you won't. Crucio." Harry opened his eyes. "That's what he cast."
"Cruciatus," Hermione confirmed. "The pain curse. That wouldn't have killed him immediately. Though, how he got away."
Ron looked searchingly at Harry. "Do you remember that, Harry? I mean, how the slimy git got away?"
Harry shook his head.
"I woke up when he collapsed." The three of them stared at each other for a few minutes. Then Ron slung a friendly arm around Harry's shoulders.
"So, Harry, pal, would you care to explain why this is the first we've heard of this little incident?"
After lunch, Kurama stood alongside his teammates in a short line on the grounds before the school. He alternately eyed the sharp-faced, yellow-eyed woman facing them and the brooms lying neatly before them. He ignored Genkai, standing between them and the castle like a scowling muggle construction barrel. She was certainly the right color at the moment. Past her, he could sense a few curious students peeping out from windows, or the top of the wall, or the front gate. The professor, who'd introduced herself as Madame Hooch, glared at them all impartially. "Unlike other classes, mine does not run through fifth year. You will either pass, or you will be placed in remedial lessons. Stand to the left of a broomstick, hold out your hand over it, and say, 'Up,'" she commanded. Dubiously, Kurama stepped forward. He didn't really expect this to work. Only Botan had the kind of magic that lent itself to levitation, though Keiko might as well. They hadn't had the time to test the human girl's abilities yet. He held out his right hand over the broomstick, seeing everyone else do the same out of the corner of his eye. "Up!" the Tante chorused. Showers of incandescent sparks exploded from the brooms. Kurama staggered back, squinting through the glare, his arms up to block the stinging sparks from his face, as the girls shrieked and Kuwabara yelped.
"What the hell?" Yusuke shouted.
Past his spread fingers, Kurama dimly saw Botan's broom shoot into the sky, riderless. A moment later, Hiei's broom burst into flames, and all the brooms stopped throwing out sparks. Kurama cautiously lowered his arms, wary eyes flicking from his broom, which had put out shoots and leaf buds, and now resembled a bush rather than a broom, to his teammates. Hiei was irritably collecting the fire, handful by handful, and banishing it before it got into the grass and went out of control. Yukina was half-hidden behind Kuwabara, peering at the flattened lump of ice gluing her broom to the ground. Surprisingly, Yusuke's broom was hovering obediently a meter off the ground, and Botan's... Ah, yes, it had taken off. Kurama looked up and saw the riderless broom slowly doing loops 10 stories above them.
"I'm so terribly sorry," Botan gasped to Madame Hooch. She bowed low to the shocked professor. "I'll go get it."
Absolute! Botan flicked her wrist, summoning her oar and shot away. "Tly not," Madam Hooch finished. "Sheeny may!"
"Madam Hooch, if I may," Genkai began. "This is their first actual casting of Western magic. I think I know where the problem is. Let me get them straightened out, so you can finish the test without further damage to school property."
Madam Hooch nodded curtly, and Genkai stepped forward, barking orders. "Miss Korim, defrost your broom. Yurameshi, Kuwabara, Yukimura, remove yours before they catch fire from Jaganshi's. Minamino, if you would, there are more brooms in the shed by the Quidditch pitch. Fetch two to replace yours and Jaganshi's."
Kurama ran off.
By the time Kurama returned, Botan had wrestled her broom back to the ground, and Yukina had managed to free hers from her ice without damaging it. The group had moved the line back to clear ground, and Kurama set the replacements down and faced Genkai. The old woman's face was blank as she eyed the seven of them.
"Can any of you tell me what you did wrong?"
Silence.
"What did the professor tell you to do?"
"Hold our hands out over the brooms and say up," Yusuke grumbled.
"And what did you do?" Genkai continued. "Aside from that."
Kurama blinked in realization as the humans shifted uneasily and raised his hand.
"We reached into them with our magic as well."
Genkai's eyes flicked to him. "Did Madam Hooch tell you to do that?"
"No, Professor."
"Then why did you do it?" she snapped.
She didn't wait for anyone to reply.
"You just discovered the fundamental difference to Western magic. Try again, and this time, stick to the surface."
The Tante stepped forward once more. "Up!" Unsurprisingly, this time Botan's broom leapt smartly into her hand. Hiei's and Yusuke's did as well, with Kurama's floating into his outstretched hand a second later. The tip of Keiko's broom lifted, but the bristles remained on the ground, until it was standing upright. Kuwabara's rolled on the ground, and Yukina's stayed still. Madam Hooch took over once more.
"Again!"
"Up!" Yukina, Kuwabara, and Keiko repeated. Keiko's broom began sweeping the grass vigorously, while Kuwabara's broom rolled up next to Yukina's. He hissed under his breath.
"Command your broom. Don't cajole it," Madam Hooch ordered. "Again!"
This time, all the brooms came to their hands. "Better. Mount up." She walked the length of their line, correcting their grips.
"Miss Shinime, why are you sitting side saddle?"
"This is how I was taught, Professor,"
Botan answered.
"It won't work for a British broom. Remount correctly."
She waited a moment, then checked Botan's grip.
"Excellent," she said more quietly. "Go slowly until you get used to the way a foreign broom handles. None of what you pulled getting this one to the ground, understand?"
"Yes, ma'am."
The professor raised her voice once more.
"When I blow my whistle, you are to kick off the ground. Rise a few feet, then lean forward slightly and come straight down. 3, 2, 1.
Madam Hooch drilled them for the next 20 minutes in taking off, landing, and turning the brooms. Finally, satisfied with their ability not to get themselves killed, she blew her whistle and ordered them to fly in a large circle around her, doing whatever they felt comfortable with. Botan kicked off and shot 5 stories into the air, doing a barrel roll on the way up, then spiraled up another several meters and began doing vertical loops.
"Can't let her hog all the fun," Yusuke said cheerfully,
kicking off to arrow towards the fairy girl. Hiei and Kurama followed a bit more slowly. They reached Yusuke hovering off to one side under Botan, watching the fairy girl try to combine her loops with a corkscrew turn.
"She's certainly putting that broom through its paces," Kurama murmured appreciatively.
"She's psycho!" Yusuke turned to them with a wicked grin. "Wanna thread the needle?"
"Pardon?" Kurama hadn't heard that right, had he?
"Thread the needle," Yusuke repeated, pointing up at Botan, "before she gets bored of looping around."
Hiei snorted. "You're psycho," he smirked. Let's. Yusuke glanced towards Kurama expectantly. Kurama shook his head, smiling as he declined.
I think I should stay to catch Botan when you crash into her.
Whatever, man, Yusuke retorted. You're just jealous. He zipped off, Hiei close on his heels, and they darted neatly through Botan's loop, Yusuke tugging lightly at the girl's dangling ponytail on the way.
Yusuke, you rat!
Botan shrieked, clutching at her scalp and skittering sideways. Kurama chuckled behind his hand as Yusuke turned tail and flew for his life, with Botan in outraged pursuit. The kitsune glanced down, idly curious about the general reaction to their antics. Even from his high vantage, Kurama could tell that the flight instructor was not amused, and judging by the look she cast after Genkai, was wondering what was so special about this group of adolescents. Hiei made sure that he walked near Yukina as they returned to the castle. The others were bounding ahead, excited, laughing, and windblown, thrilled at their successful use of Western magic. Hiei himself was surprised, noting that this magic was nothing like the Jigan or his fire. As if reading his thoughts, Yukina's soft but exceedingly happy voice interrupted his thoughts.
That was the first time I've done magic that wasn't ice or healing. It was strange.
Hiei glanced over at his sister, eyebrow raised. She lifted her eyes, smiling shyly.
And exhilarating.
It was, he responded. They reached the door to the school as it was closing behind the rest of the group. Hiei caught it and held it open for Yukina as they entered.
To fly, she murmured. I never imagined I would.
Hiei had. As an infant learning his fire magic, too young and too fast, he tried to teach himself to soar like a spark from a bonfire. He'd never mastered the technique, but what little he could manage had saved his life more than once. He offered a slight nod of agreement, but Yukina turned pensive once more.
Oni-san, the other magics, do you think?
She turned a familiar, hopeful look on Hiei, and he winced.
Might they?
Hi! A hand clapped down on each of Hiei's shoulders. He stiffened, clamping down on the instinct to attack, and glared up at the offenders flanking him. He recognized the pair who'd booby-trapped Genkai's door last night. They were beaming at Yukina. You're Yukina Korim, aren't you? One asked. It's nice to meet you. I'm Fred, and he's my twin, George, the other said, not giving her a chance to answer. Nice to have another set of twins in the school, isn't it? The Patils are nice enough, but they don't care for us much. Can't imagine why. Do you mind if we borrow your brother for a minute? They tugged Hiei away as Yukina murmured that they could. Let go, Hiei snarled ineffectively. Can't do that, sorry, Fred told him. We need to talk to you, George added. Nice flying, by the way. We saw you on the pitch. You should try out for Quidditch. And you're a meshi, too. We won't judge against you for ratting us out to the teachers. But we don't appreciate that sort of thing, even though we got points out of it. Hiei blinked. Their rapid-fire dialogue was disorienting. What? Fred grinned. 5 points for successfully pulling a prank on Genkai. And detention, but we're used to that. No, Hiei snapped. What do you mean, ratting you out? The twins stopped. You told Genkai we did it. The hell I did? He twisted loose, incensed. He would never give out that much information. Not for the low amount she could pay. I said there was more than one. That's it. Fred and George shared a look. Who else would have told her? George asked. Who else would have blamed us first? They sighed and simultaneously answered,
Everyone.
She got us, George groaned. She did indeed, Fred agreed, his eyes brightening. However shall we respond? Their mouths started to curve wickedly. Hiei smirked. Enjoy detention.
We will.
It was incredible. It was wonderful. It was perfect. And best of all,
Draco hadn't had to make it up. He listened in vindictive pleasure as his house tore into dinner and the beginnings of the transfer student's flight exam with equal fervor. The most disastrous starts, and therefore the best ones to insult, had been Minamino's and Giganchi's. Draco could rip into that bastard Minamino in public without singling himself out for retaliation.
"It's just terrible," Pansy cooed, oozing false sympathy across the table at Minamino. "It must be so embarrassing for you, ruining your broom like that. Even Longbottom never damaged his back in first year."
That was a brilliant point. Pansy was in excellent form tonight, Draco thought.
"I do hope they aren't charging you for it," she asked. "Broomsticks are terribly expensive."
Minamino smiled weakly at her. "So I've noticed. The silver does seem ridiculously high-priced. One would think it was formal kimono."
Draco ignored the strange comment. "Can't you afford it, Minamino?"
he sneered.
"With my pocket money?" the redhead replied. "Of course not. I'm going to have to write to Kasan. Do you know if Gringotts will exchange yen?"
"They don't,"
Draco lied smugly. Minamino's face fell.
"Oh, that is unfortunate. What about Okane?"
"I'm afraid not."
"Such backwards creatures, goblins," Minamino grumbled. He turned a charming smile on Draco, and the blonde tensed.
"You seem very knowledgeable, Mr. Malfoy."
Draco relaxed slightly. "Most wizards wouldn't even know the difference between Okane and yen. It's refreshing that you do."
Draco raised his chin haughtily. It was about time Minamino began to behave properly towards him.
"I try to keep abreast of these things. It's that sort of knowledge that sorts the wheat from the chaff."
"Very true. I was wondering, though," the redhead smile sweetened, "since you know the difference between Okane and yen, perhaps you can explain to me the difference between galleons and money?"
Draco flushed in outrage.
"And on that note, gentlemen," Minamino stood, smiling directly at Draco, "I believe I shall take my leave of you." He bowed politely. "Gochso samadeshta. Enjoy your dessert."
The redhead left, as Slytherins turned to face Draco in confusion. "Don't look at me," he snapped. "I don't know what the hell he said either."
Hiei made his way down a moonlit corridor, somewhere in the upper levels of a tower near the Hufflepuff dormitories. He kept to the shadows, constantly scanning the hallway in both directions for danger. Not out of necessity, though it would be awkward to explain the katana belted at his waist, but simply by preference and habit. He caught movement high in the corner of his vision and spun, dropping into a defensive stance, though he didn't draw the weapon. There, on the wall near the ceiling, a spider web's trailing end drifted on the air currents. Hiei's eyes narrowed. The web should have been firmly anchored to the wall at its lower corner. He was fairly sure it hadn't been unanchored and adrift a second before. Stepping closer, he sized up the web and eyed the spot it would have needed to be attached at to be taut. A thin, gray-green line snaked through that spot, running roughly parallel to the ceiling. Hiei followed the line in the direction he'd come from, guessing that he would have seen the movement if its approach hadn't been blocked by the filmy web. The line split into three at the first door he came to. One segment continued on, and from there he could see the tip of it as it sped forward. Another squeezed through the door at a tiny gap in the upper corner, and the third stretched upwards a single centimeter and then curled out from the wall, a tiny, curved, transparent disc dangling from the end, the convex side pointing not quite downwards. Hiei cursed under his breath, darted to the nearest window, and climbed out. Taking the roofs and windowsills of the castle, he flickered to the ground, then across to the fence, keeping the students away from the castle's lakeside. He made his way down to the bluff, sheer for most humans, but with enough handholds for an expert freehand rock climber, or a nimble, lightweight demon, and alighted on a windowsill. Five windows over, he found the one he wanted,
pushed his way fully onto the ledge, and crossed his arms to glare down at Kurama.
"Hello, Hiei," the pajama-clad teen said calmly. "Do come in. You're blocking me."
"Good," Hiei snapped, not moving. "You've done enough. You're getting clumsy. I saw one of your damn spy eyes settling into place."
Kurama sighed. "I know you did, but I'm being more careful where other people could see."
Hiei snorted softly in disbelief.
"I have to finish this tonight, Hiei," Kurama said. "I can't spend Monday recharging in a tree. We have classes."
Hiei glared at him, silent, waiting. Kurama matched his gaze firmly.
"Please."
"Damn it," Hiei thought. "I suppose you expect me to haul you over to your bed when you collapse," he snapped, giving in ungraciously.
"I'm not going to collapse," Kurama answered, as Hiei pushed past him and leaned against the wall, crossing his arms.
Kurama reached back outside the window, presumably grasping this end of his vine, and stilled. Both demons spent the next hour perfectly still, Hiei standing watch over Kurama, and Kurama feeding his power into the vine. A broad leaf in Kurama's free hand, within the line of sight of both demons, flickered with images of the upper levels of Hogwarts. At last, the leaf showed a tiny, dusty attic space, and went blank. Kurama let the leaf fall out of the window, dangling from its vine, and sagged against the wall.
"I'm done," he said.
"Good," Hiei answered. "Bed." Hiei raised an eyebrow, frowning knowingly. "You can't move, can you?"
"Well, no."
"Idiot." Hiei pushed himself from the wall and draped Kurama over his shoulders in a fireman's carry.
"Hiei?"
"Shut up." He dumped Kurama unceremoniously onto the fox's bed, tossed the covers up over him, and climbed onto the foot of the bed.
"Take off your boots," Kurama mumbled, already falling asleep. "It's unsanitary."
"You can wash the blanket," Hiei snapped, pulling the curtains closed. He sat back against the bedpost, inside the curtains, and loosened his katana, bracing himself with the sheath and his legs so he wouldn't fall over if he fell asleep. He settled in for the night.